Shalom, everyone. I'm Monty Judah with Lion of Lamb Ministries. Welcome to our program. We decided to do a program that really focuses in on the two of the commandments that are in the Ten Commandments, the second and third commandment. And our program is entitled False Gods and Idols. Now, normally, when we bring up the subject of idolatry, and idolatry deals with the worship of false gods as well as idols, we tend to look at that whole subject as an ancient sin. This is a sin that's been done by the generations and the different countries and nations and ethnic groups that are before that didn't know the Lord. But we who know the Lord, why, we don't have those issues anymore. We don't have false gods amongst us, and we certainly don't have idolatry because we're all committed to following the Lord. However, at the same time we say that, we use this word idol quite frequently in our common language. For example, there's a singing program that they have on television, very popular, and it's called American Idol, you know, where you idolize the person who's a good singer. And of course, in professional sports, we idolize certain players, good quarterbacks in pro football and good basketball players in the NBA and so forth. And so we have some of this stuff all around us, and maybe we didn't realize that there's more of it going on than we have paid attention to in the past. This program, I want to focus in on God's commandments about this subject. So with that said, I want to take you back to the base of Mount Sinai. There's Moses with the children of Israel. They've come out of Egypt. They've come back to the mountain that God told them, Moses, to bring the people to. God's come down on the mountain at Mount Sinai, and God is now going to speak his Ten Commandments. When he begins to speak to them, the first thing he says is, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's not an introduction to the commandments. That actually is the first commandment of the Ten Commandments. Now, I realize it wasn't written in, shall we say, the imperative mood. In other words, when people first read that and they say, well, what is the commandment? Their first thought is it's not given as a commandment. It's kind of an indicative statement. It indicates something. It's giving information. But there is an inherent commandment in it. The commandment is, this is the God you're supposed to believe in. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. I want you to believe in me. I don't want you to just have the commandment to believe in God. I want you to believe in me, the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Now, let me just for a moment speak to a lot of my Christian friends who say, well, they believe in Jesus. They believe in the Messiah. If I could take you back to John 3:16, when Yeshua was talking to Nicodemus, John 3:16 starts off by saying, we're supposed to believe in the God, the Father, who sent the Son. Which God sent the Son? The God who brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. That's the God we're supposed to be believing in. And that's the one connected with the Messiah. And the Messiah himself said, I and the Father are one. When you believe in the Messiah, you believe in the same God who brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. We got to make sure we got the right God. Now, the rest of the commandments that follow are going to be connected to that God. And so when we read the next commandment, which says, you shall have no other gods before me, he's referring to, I'm the God who brought the children of Israel out of Egypt. I'm the one that sends the Messiah to you. I don't want any other gods to be associated with me. You're not to have another God. Now, the phrase says, before me. Now, obviously, God doesn't want another God to be put in front of him that we would show attention to. In other words, he doesn't want to be in second place with any God. He's in first place with us. There is no second place. Let me change the word ever so slightly, and I'm not really changing the meaning. Let me change the word in this verse, you shall have no other gods with me. That's just as true as before me. God not only does not want another God to be before him and in first place in your life, he doesn't want to share his position with you with another God. There's a very famous theologian, his name was Spurgeon. He made an interesting statement about this whole subject where he said that in every man, there's a God-shaped vacuum. And man goes around trying to fill that vacuum with a variety of things so that he can fill that hole that's in his life. The only God that's going to fill that vacuum correctly, that will fit in there correctly, is the God of Israel and the Messiah. They're the only God that will fit in there. They're the creator God. That shape of that hole for God in your soul is from the creator. If you try to fill that with other things or with part of God and other things, and so it's not going to work. You are going to be frustrated. It will not be satisfying. And oh, by the way, God says, I'm not going to cooperate with you doing that. I'm not going to cooperate with you. I will not tolerate another God with me, before me, or anything else mixed with me as God. You're going to only receive me as God, and that's the way it's going to be. You want to believe in me? This is the definition of how you believe in me. No other gods before me. He goes on to then give the third commandment. You shall not make for yourself an idol, or any likeness of what is in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the water under the earth. See, it turns out that idols are actually imitations of something else. And you give the attribute of being God with adoration and with love and respect. And you give things to an idol that you're supposed to give to God. You defraud God of those things, and you give it to these things you call idols. I want you to note, he says, anything that's up above, stars, the sun, the moon, birds, anything on the earth, any animal, any structure here, a mountain, anything that you see here on the earth, things in the water, any kind of fish, anything that's down in the structure of that and so forth, you will not form an idol with regard to any of that. You're not going to take stone. You're not going to take wood. You're not going to take any precious stones or gold or whatever to form a shape that you will then render adoration toward, or that you will equate as being equal to God or greater than God. He says, none of that is going to be acceptable. Now, this is what makes this commandment interesting. And by the way, this is what the heart of my program I'm coming to share with you about. Are we going to talk about false gods and idols that are in the world? Yes, yes, we're going to talk about that. But that's not really what the intent of this program is. You already see the stuff around us. In fact, it's rampant around us. And we can see the history of what has been done by different ethnic groups, different nations in the past, and as they tried to fill that God-shaped vacuum that they had in them from the Creator. We're not going to focus on that, but we will give some clarifying definitions to it. But we're going to focus in on why does God get so upset about this? Why is, you know, I mean, it's one thing to give the commandment. It's a whole nother thing to give the commandment and then make a very terse statement about it. In fact, let me continue to read to you what he says in Exodus 20, verse 5, after he said, don't make any idols. You shall not worship them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, inflicting the punishment of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing favor to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. I want you to take note of something. When it came to the subject of false gods and idols, this is the first time he's talking about there's a punishment that comes with invoking this. If you make me jealous, I will punish you. And in fact, he goes so far as to say, not only Am I going to punish you? I will punish your children and your grandchildren for what you have done. Now, I guess God takes this business about him being the creator and you not recognizing him for being the creator very seriously. And he gives himself an emotional attribute. He says that he's a jealous God. This program, we're going to focus in on that a little bit. He says he's a jealous God. But why is he so jealous? Why has he got a problem with this? You know? And we're going to talk about the whole concept of jealousy, and there's different definitions for jealousy. We're going to talk about what part of that definition is God referring to versus what you may have heard about that word jealousy. Now, it's very clear that if you take anything and you call upon it and you invoke where you're asking for help from it, and like you would do with God, and it's directed towards something else, you have now made that to be a God. When you pray and you ask God for things, you're recognizing God is there and you're communicating with God. And if you do that with an idol or with a false god, you're doing the same thing with it. He says, that's part of not having a false god before me. That's part of you shall not make idols, because it's what you do with them that God gets so irritated about. If you praise them, if you offer thanksgiving to them, if you grant them authority over your life, you have defrauded God of what rightfully belongs to him as creator, as redeemer of this earth. You have taken some of the glory of God, some of the praise that belongs to God, and you misapplied it over to another god, to an idol, and you basically stolen from God and do it. Another way of putting it, since we're in covenant with God, and this is an intimate covenant relationship we have with God, God's literally, his spirit is literally in us and so forth, if you mess around with an idol and you mess around with another false god, you're committing spiritual adultery. You're being unfaithful to your relationship with God. It's the measure of being unfaithful. Now, there's a lot of other commandments that can show lack of faith. There's a lot of other commandments that continue on. But this is the one that speaks to the heart of your relationship with God. I know a lot of people who love God, but make a lot of mistakes and sin. You know, occasionally they tell a fib. They lust after something they shouldn't lust after. But we don't question them with regard to their relationship with God. We just say they sinned, they transgressed. But here he's talking about not only transgressing, he's talking about it directly affects the relationship. And God says it so directly affects him, and that he is a jealous God, that he steps up and does something about it. Let's take the subject of just a man and a wife. Why is it the wife gets so upset when she discovers that her husband has stepped out of the marriage and went and did something inappropriate, even socialized with another woman as opposed to her, that did something deceitful, that instead of giving all the praise and preference and so forth to his wife, he showed affection and thanksgiving and praise to another woman. Of course she's going to be jealous, and rightfully so, because she's been defrauded of things her husband vowed to give her, to prefer her above all others, to be passionate for her, to love her more than all the others. And when he goes out and commits adultery, or he gets in a kind of a relationship where it puts this, well, it invokes jealousy on her part. The same thing applies to a man. We, the bride of the Messiah, when we do things of that nature, showing attention and interest and praise and thanksgiving to things other than God, and put that thing above or before God, why, it provokes God to jealousy. And he's saying that. Now, maybe we didn't realize that God has that kind of emotion, but he does. And he acknowledges it, and he's trying to explain that he does. He has that thing in his heart. He has those feelings with regard to it. Anytime we take and this fits within the definition of idolatry in particular, anytime you take a thing and you value it greater than God, you are bordering into what is called idolatry. In other words, you've taken this thing and you've put value to it, and you put that value as greater than, and it's usually stuff here in the world, you know. And in a little bit in this program, we're probably going to cover some of the more common things that we see that command our attention. Like, for example, football, sports of all type, they command our attention. The entertainment world commands our attention. And if we elevate those things where they command all of our attention to the exclusion of God, and we deny God certain things of attention that we normally were doing before, and we choose the other, we consciously choose the other above God, you're practicing idolatry. And God says, I'm going to punish you for it. You're not going to get away with it. I don't put up with it. I will punish you for it. The children of Israel, why did they get kicked out of the promised land? Why were they cast into the nations? They had other gods before God, before the God of Israel. They demonstrated a rejection of the Messiah. They rejected the prophets. They killed the prophets. They at every interval, they wanted to get more involved with the gods of the other nations around them and be a part of those things rather than the God who actually brought them out of Egypt, took them through the wilderness, put them in the promised land, made a covenant with them, and was helping them and causing blessings to be upon them. And still, they said, let's have other gods, you know, before it. And the practice of idolatry is what that was about. One of the first instances that we have where we see the children of Israel dealing with this is shortly after God gave the Ten Commandments. You know, Moses went back up on the mountain, and he was up there for 40 days and 40 nights. And during that time, while the patience of the children of Israel grew thin, they couldn't wait that long, and all of a sudden, they got the idea, you know, let's make a god. I mean, they just got through hearing God speak from the mountain. The mountain's still on fire. There's smoke coming off of it. Moses went up there. He knows Moses is up there talking to God. And let's have a god down here. And so a group of them got the gold together, and they forced Aaron into the proposition, and they made a golden calf. Now, that golden calf is kind of interesting because theologians have tried to trace that back. Oh, that must be one of the Egyptians' gods they learned about. And yes, it's true. The children of Israel were familiar with the Egyptian gods at that time. They had been down there for several generations. They knew about Egyptian gods. But this golden calf thing didn't fit into the idea of being an Egyptian god. That golden calf doesn't fit into Egyptian gods. So what's that golden calf fit into? This is their imaginations. Their imaginations is the thing. Well, we got God up here on the mountain. We haven't heard from him lately and so forth. Let's make something down here, and we'll have God down here with us. So they decided to make a golden calf, and they thought that would be a representation of that God that they had heard from, you know, previously, the God that had led Moses and brought him out. They thought it would be a representation of that God. In fact, once they made it, they announced, this is the God who brought us out of the land of Egypt. You remember the first words that God spoke, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's what they said about the golden calf. And they were really trying to make a representation of what the God they had not seen that brought them out of Egypt. So they decided to make it so that God would be dwelling amongst them and they would have a little more say over the whole situation and so forth. And of course, that was a classic case of idolatry. You shall not make any image of me, he said, or a god, out of anything that is above the earth, on the earth, or in the sea below the earth. You will not do it. But what'd they do? They got a calf. Now, a calf to them was a high-prized item for a meal. You know, that's good beef, that's veal, that's a tasty meal. And so they took the thing that they kind of adored the most in their food supply, and they made a god out of something that they adored and they liked. And they made it out of gold, it was precious and could be praised and so forth. And they did exactly what God said, don't do. And as you know, the story goes why God came down and destroyed that. Moses came down, and the people that participated in it summarily died. In fact, the scripture records for us there were about 3,000 children of Israel that participated in that, and the Levites took up swords. God commanded them to do it, and they went and slew their own brethren who had participated in that. God takes this business of idolatry very seriously. He is a very jealous God. Let me take you to a couple of other passages of Scripture that address the subject of God's jealousy. And I'm going to take you all the way back to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and where it announces that he is a jealous God. He had this business that he was a jealous God before we ever got to the Ten Commandments. Let me read to you from Exodus 34, beginning at verse 14. For you shall not worship any other god besides the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Otherwise, you might make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they would prostitute themselves with their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and someone might invite you to eat of his sacrifice, that you might take some of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters might prostitute themselves with their gods, and cause your sons also to prostitute themselves with their gods. That instruction was given after the Ten Commandments. And it's trying to remind the children of Israel, hey, this business didn't just start when we got to the Ten Commandments and we got to there. You know, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, your relationship with me is based on that God, the God that Abraham had descendants, and I prophesied to Abraham, your descendants will go down in a strange land. They'll be down there for four generations, and then I will bring them up. Well, here's God. I'm the God that brought you out of the land of Egypt. See, the God that brought out of the land of Egypt, he's the original God that was working with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In fact, he was the God that prophesied to Abraham, your descendants will get into Egypt and I'll bring them out. You know, that same God, and the jealousy of that God is the same as it was from the very beginning. Now, here's this instruction from Moses in Exodus 34. This is after the event of the golden calf. So we see what God did when we built the golden calf, and boy, he didn't like that, and a bunch of people got punished from it. And now as they're traveling and getting ready to go into the promised land, they're out in the wilderness and so forth, he's warning them. He said, be very careful when you come into contact with other peoples because they're going to want to invite you over and socialize with you, and they're going to want to introduce their gods to you. And they're going to try to get their sons to marry your daughters and get your daughters to marry their sons. And then the next thing you know, we're going to have a whole bunch of idolaters and you guys are going to turn in and start doing what the other nations do. And we don't want that to happen. When we get toward the end of the Exodus story, there's going to be a scenario in which that we're going to hear this story about a man named Balaam. Balaam is a prophet of God, We believe he was a real prophet, but he wasn't connected with Moses. But in the ancients, he was known as a prophet of the Creator God. And the Midianites, and in particular Balak, who's an Ammonite, he doesn't like the children of Israel traveling along the edge of his lands, getting ready to go in the Promised Land. He wants to invoke from Balaam, this prophet of God, he wants to invoke the forces of God to stop the children of Israel so that he doesn't have to worry about them. And so he hires Balaam. Now, you know the story of Balaam. He comes, he sets up the altars, he tries to invoke a curse upon the children of Israel. He's unsuccessful. He ends up blessing them instead. Balaam is very upset about, Balak is very upset about that, and so forth. But they got to have another conversation. And he ends up talking to the five Midianite kings that are along there with Balak. And he says, look, he says, you're really going about this the wrong way. If you really want to destroy the children of Israel, if you really want to mess them up, what you want to do is you want to get them to offend God. Because if they offend God, God will destroy them. And God has on notice with everywhere, I don't put up with other gods. So all you got to do is get the children of Israel to participate with your daughters and your sons in your festivals about other gods and other customs and so forth, and they'll turn away from the God of Israel, and the God of Israel will punish them and destroy and render them weak and so forth. And you don't have to take your army and go out and fight them. All you got to do is get them compromised, and so they get in trouble with their God, and their God comes and destroys them. And the five Midianite kings, they said, hey, what a great idea. Hey, that's how you would stop someone who's believing in the God of Israel. By the way, it's the same method and same tactic if you're a believer in Yeshua and somebody wants to turn you away from the faith. They don't have to fight you or argue with you about it. All they have to do is get you to play along in some of their fun and their festivities, and eventually you'll adapt those things. You'll adopt what they're doing, and then next thing you know, you're on the wrong side of the ledger from God, and then God is the one who takes care of you. That's how spiritual warfare is done. It's by throwing up false gods and creating idols. That's spiritual warfare. Now, a lot of my Christian brethren, they talk about spiritual warfare a lot. You know what the number one weapon of the enemy is for spiritual warfare? Idolatry. False gods. You know, you don't have to attack God. Just throw more gods into the mix and mix him with other gods. Mix him with other idolatrous practices. Don't keep the commandments of the Lord. Don't do the feasts of the Lord. You come up with your own feasts. Come up with your own celebrations. That's how you get them. And guess what happened to the house of Israel when they split off? Do you remember the famous statement of that got them so much trouble? They said, we believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That all sounds right. But we're still going to bake cakes to the Queen of Heaven. What did God think about that? He said, not on my watch. And the house of Israel went into captivity first. They were dispersed first. Even though they were keeping the festivals and they were proclaiming the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as their God, but they still wanted to mix it with other gods. And God said, not going along with this. And we have a clear example of how the whole house of Israel went into captivity first. Then, to continue on with our story about Balaam, the Midianite kings, they took up Balaam's counsel. So here are the children of Israel, they're on the brink. This is the generation that's going to be crossing over the Jordan, is going to go in the Promised Land after the 40 years in the wilderness. And they invite the children of Israel to come over to one of their festivals. It was right near where they were at. And they have a nice party. And the young men of Israel go over and fraternize with the young ladies over there, the Midianite ladies. And the young men over there, they come over and fraternize with the daughters of Israel. And the next thing you know, all of a sudden they rise up and they say, we're not going to do what Moses said. We're going to do what we want to do. See, that's what happens when you get into idolatry. All of a sudden you start denying God's commandments and you want to make the rules for yourself. You want to choose which God. You want to choose the rules that we follow. That's what idolatry produces. So God got very angry over that deal. And in fact, there was one fellow that really brought it to the focus. There was a Simeonite man who came forward with this Midianite woman and defiantly, in front of Moses and Aaron and the elders of Israel, said they were going to do whatever they decided to do. In fact, he said, I'm going to demonstrate it to you. I'm going to go in that tent right there, and I'm going to have intimate intercourse with that woman right there, despite what you say. And they did. They went in the tent. And then we're introduced to one of the sons of Aaron. His name is Phinehas. And Phinehas sees what's going on. Nobody else is acting. Phinehas grabs a spear, runs into the tent, and impales both of them together on the same spear. Kills both of them. And God, who had sent a plague amongst the children of Israel, stopped the plague suddenly. And he announced that because of the jealousy of Phinehas, to be my jealousy, he said, I have stopped the judgment, and I'm going to grant to Phinehas the covenant of peace, and I'm going to make him the perpetual priesthood for all of Israel. Wow. God got real serious about that. Only 24,000 sons and daughters of Israel died in that little episode before Phinehas stopped it, so not all Israel died because of that event. Again, what was it? Idolatry. False gods, mixing with others. God has got this problem about this jealousy business. And for some reason, we hear these stories and we don't quite get it, how jealous he really is, how he treats this subject for it. Let me read to you from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 15. And I'm going to read a couple of scriptures to you about how God is described by Moses to us. In Deuteronomy 6, verse 15, it says, for the Lord your God, who is in the midst of you, is a jealous God, so follow him, or else the anger of the Lord your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth. Let me reread that to you. You need to get this verse. For the Lord your God, who is in the midst of you, is a jealous God. So follow him, or else the anger of the Lord of your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth. By the way, that applies to you if you believe in the Messiah. Now, I know you're probably sitting there going, oh, well, I believe in the Messiah, so that threat about, you know, being wiped off the face of the earth doesn't really count for me. Yes, it does. And let me say to you, my fellow American citizens, while this country was formed based on a belief, a Judeo-Christian ethic, it was based on the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we go back to the fathers of this nation. They all had a testimony of faith in that God. And they believed they were forming a nation that would be a righteous nation. But our nation has now changed. And in the course of many generations since our nation was formed, we've come to the point where we've got all manner of idolatry going on in this world. And the God of Israel, the God that our founding fathers believed in, is not the predominant God of belief in this nation anymore. You know what that means, don't you? That God's threat to take our nation and wipe us off the face of the earth is just as valid today as it was when he made that statement to Israel. And he's already demonstrated for us to see if Israel doesn't obey this commandment, what happens to them? They were completely removed from the land of Israel and scattered into the nations. By all rights and means, it looked like they were about to be wiped out. The only thing that kept them from being wiped out is God's promises to our fathers that he would still sustain us and keep us. He wouldn't completely destroy us. He would bring us back. And we've seen God mercy and grace to do that. Let me take you to a couple other verses. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 16. They made him jealous with strange gods. With abominations, they provoked him to anger. Now, a lot of people think, you know, hey, when you have a false god and so forth, I'm not really trying to make God angry. Yes, you do. You make him angry. If you decide that you're going to have something in your life more important than God, and you claim to be a believer God, you are making him angry. His jealousy turns into anger and resentment. Verse 17, it goes on, they sacrificed to demons. They gave gifts and valuable things to these other things. By the way, some of these false gods that we're talking about, they're actually run by demons. And we're going to go through a couple of them where they say that they believe they're actual demons that do these. Who were not God, to gods whom they have not known, new gods who came lately, whom your fathers did not know. We have gods running around in our nation that our founding fathers never knew anything about. They didn't have that temptation. We have it. Verse 21, Deuteronomy 32. They have made me jealous with what is not God. They have provoked me to anger with their idols. So I will make them jealous with those who are not a people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. Wow. God says, not only can my punishment be full of anger, I will do to you what you have done to me. Well, that only, quite honestly, that only seems righteous. If you want to irritate God, well, he's going to come back and irritate you. He's going to turn that thing that you used against the God, and he's going to turn that against you. That should be fair warning for you that maybe you need to pay attention to this subject, because you could do yourself in thinking that you were doing the right thing. Joshua 24, verse 19. Then Joshua said to the people, you will not be able to serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your wrongdoing or your sins. And he was referring to them going into the nation and running into all these different peoples, and they had different gods. Do not mingle with those people. Do not take up their gods that they have. Let me give you one more verse, and this is going to open up for our next episode. We're going to talk about, in particular, with this definition of this word jealous. When God says, I'm a jealous God, we're going to talk about what is he really referring to. Because jealousy has a couple of different definitions for us, and I want to make sure that we have the definition of jealousy that God uses as opposed to necessarily what you might use. Nahum, the book of Nahum, chapter 1, verse 2, it says, a jealous and avenging God is the Lord. The Lord is avenging and wrathful. The Lord takes vengeance on his adversaries, and he reserves wrath for his enemies. Did you know the people who have the false gods that come and share those false gods with his people, the wrath of God is waiting on those people? You know, it's a little bit like, the way a man would take vengeance against someone who led to the harm that was done. It's not just the person who did the harm, but the person who led them to get the harm. They're going to get punished as well. And that's the way God sees as his enemies that are set up, even the ones that are propping others up to do it. Now, this essentially is our first episode. We're introducing the subject of false gods and idols. And in our next episode, I want to share with you much more detail about when it says that God is a jealous God, what exactly does that mean? What's it mean when he says he's a jealous God? Join me in that next program. Shalom to all of you.